When you find reality is yanked violently from straight ahead to the hard insane right, you know you're off the beaten path. Defenestrate Media and The Left Show present The Sidetrack with Jason Williams.
Welcome to The Sidetrack. I'm Jason Williams. If you've been playing along through our Beating Trump series over the last several months here on The Left Show platform, it's generally me trying to say to everyone out there that the Democratic Party needs a plan, no shit, but they also need to finally embrace what Democratic Party activists, what progressives, what even to some extent the moderates of the party have been trying to say to the Democratic Party for nearly 30 years. The Democratic Party has never fully recovered from the gun-shy, crouched in a corner, whatever are we going to do post-Reagan years. We dabbled with the DLC and centrism. That went well. Actually, I mean, it didn't go that poorly, but it did leave the party with not a clue after Clinton. And we saw that play out. Forgotten here in the craziness of the Trump era is the 2004 election in which Democrats ran that centrist again and lost to someone who now is remembered as a centrist because of his predecessor, Donald Trump. In contrast, George Bush Jr. is a centrist. But if you remember the campaign of 2004, you could maybe see him a different way. Why has this worked for Republicans? And why have Democrats always been afraid to try it? Why do we now have a media that defaults to Democrats needing to compromise and moderate without similar calls from the pundit class or the Beltway media for Republicans to do the same? Why do we always hear about the extremism of the political left with a separation offered to the political right from the party apparatus? Are the two really separate? Something to explore. But this does get back to our overall goal here of understanding not only how Democrats can best position themselves as a party and as individual candidates from congressional races on up to beating Donald Trump in 2020, but also the Democratic Party finally discovering who they are. And gross oversimplifications abound. There are, despite that, cases where things get very simple. And I'm going to go ahead and simplify this as much as possible. The trouble for Democrats is corporatism. Period. Now, this is something not unique to the Democratic Party. This is something that Republicans have also embraced. Republicans, though, have the benefit of the corporatism not being in opposition to the most ideological wings of the party's base. For Democrats, that's not the case. Other than that, this is one area where the two parties are very similar. Corporatism leads to an elite of sorts that functions outside of the most vocal activists, outside of the most hard-line ideologues within a party. And so the corporatism slides under the radar to a large extent. So back up just a little bit here.
Recently,
I've talked several times on the Sidetrack episodes over the last year about the wonderful writing of Eric Levitz at New York Magazine. He writes the Intelligencer column at New York Magazine, and I really recommend you spend some time getting to know Eric Levitz and what he has to say. Whether it be his Twitter account or his longer form columns at the New York Magazine, he, out of anyone else that I've read on this issue and the future of the Democratic Party, seems to get it more than even party leadership at this point. I've talked before about his October 2018 column that you really should take some time to read, titled Tribalism Isn't Our Democracy's Main Problem, the Conservative Movement Is. He makes the case in that column that there is a, quote, pernicious force hollowing out the American democracy, neutering Congress, lobotomizing the electorate, and lawmakers have become, he writes, incapable of taking action on any of the day's most pressing issues. He then spends several pages laying out the case from a political scientist perspective to a past elections perspective to a public polling in the American electorate perspective. And what he concludes, I think rightly so, is that conservative voters have come to despise the Democratic Party more than they actually loathe people like Donald Trump. Well, obviously, that seems to be the case. He writes about University of Maryland political scientist Liliana Mason's uncivil agreement, how politics became our identity. And he extrapolates on this idea that in contemporary American politics, he writes, and she writes, our conflicts are over who we think we are rather than an actual reasoned, logical formation of opinion. This is human nature. Psychologists and behavioral scientists have concluded this long ago and will tell you today this is how we function. So why isn't this translating through, especially for the Democratic Party, into an understanding of how the electorate actually sees and processes the issues of the day and how to then form a narrative that not only answers the concerns of the electorate, but also propels the Democratic Party into some form of actual identity as a party that is stronger. So the contrary argument to all of this is that where I would like to see the Democratic Party end up is the route to demagoguery. And those critics of my preferred route are right. All of this does end in demagoguery. Donald Trump is not a cause. He's a symptom of the way the American right and the Republican Party, more than happy to play along, have embraced their own form of identity politics. And a demagogue like Trump comes along because there is an opportunity for that to exist. Social identities are innate to our behavior, and that includes our voting, our political contributing, our support, our opinions, our water cooler discussions at work. All of it is inseparable from who, again, we think we are, our assumed or adopted or preferred identity. What this leads to is the messiness of polling to some extent. A lot of people will answer polls based on who they think they are, not necessarily who they really are. But does that matter? Well, no, because people also go out and vote based on who they think they are rather than who they might really be. See the trillions of think pieces on why voters vote against their own self-interest so often. So with that in mind, how does this then carry over into a discussion about the Democratic Party, its identity, all of these candidates lining up for the nomination in 2020 to run against Donald Trump in that election, and the overall future of the Democratic Party? Well, the conventional wisdom seems to be a fight between should the Democratic Party embrace very popular and very progressive policy solutions and run on those? Or should the Democratic Party embrace the identity politics already embraced by the Republican Party and Donald Trump? Or even maybe go further and embrace full-on outright class warfare attached to identity politics? The argument that I'm going to make here today, and that Levitz makes as well in his writing at New York Magazine, is that it, the idea that these are inseparable, that it's a binary choice between the two, is the failure of the Democratic Party. And the reason that failure happens goes back to where I started, the corporatism. Now, it's not as simple as just corporatism, but it is also, in a way, the mechanism with which the elites of the party frame the Democratic Party is complex. And there are a lot of moving pieces, and it has everything to do with money in politics, re-election, and the reality that Democrats, if they want to do anything, have to win more often than not. That is a reality. That's never not going to be a reality. And so money concerns, donors, large and small, and popularity with elites is never going to be something inconsequential. The problem for the Democratic Party is that they've forgotten this other part of all of this. They've forgotten that it's not a binary choice where if one switch is on, the other has to be off. It's not the case at all. Levitz explores in his writing several different themes, from the tribalism in American politics at large and how this has played out very differently in the two parties, exploring why the Republicans get a pass so often from pundits in the Beltway press, and why Democrats, again, are always more approached more often with the how are you going to compromise? How are you going to moderate? So Republicans are over here in this solid, crazy clown car, and Democrats and everyone criticizes that and talks about that and makes fun of that. But there's never really a call for Republicans to move away from that, from the conventional elites in the media or within the parties. On the left, a whole different story. You'll see it in the columns. You'll see it in internal party discussions, and you'll see it from party elites and donors. This self-imposed obligation to negotiate with that crazy clown car on the right, to moderate, to come closer to where that crazy clown car on the right is. Almost as if Democrats are expected to save our asses because the Republican Party has gone batshit insane. That's not unique to the Trump era. This is actually something that goes back quite a while. So, recently in the New York Times, really interesting research written about at the New York Times, a very extensive, in fact, I would argue one of the most extensive surveys of American voters. I think they looked at about 8,000 voters. Big grain of salt on this one. This is basically a likely voter screened survey, and it was done by a very moderate, in fact, obsessively moderate organization. Their results are worth taking a look at. And the New York Times wrote about them and concluded basically that when it comes to the most noticeable, most vocal, most attention getting, most talked about players on the left, whether it be a member of the media, an activist, a sitting congressional representative or former presidential candidate, whoever it is, the New York Times writes about this research, well, they basically conclude that they're much further left than reality. The way New York Times decides to write about this is that Twitter is not real life for Democrats. And again, it's an interesting piece of research, but what is the real takeaway here? What is the lesson to be learned for Democrats? And that's where you start to see this duality pop up again. You won't see the same conversation happen for Republicans, partly because for Republicans, it matters less within that party whether or not Twitter is real life, because, again, there's less disagreement between the ideology driving the activists and the practicalities that the party faces when it comes to donors, support, re-election, and more. So they, I guess, get away with it. For Democrats, that does exist. The ideological adherents, most devout ideologues in the party, which would be the most progressive Democratic Party activists, voting coalitions, voting blocs, all of that are opposed to what sometimes is a practical necessity for the party, money in politics. So the conclusion of the survey, Democrats on Twitter are out there a bit more than the actual electorate waiting to be gobbled up by the Democratic Party in any election cycle. Levitz of the New York Magazine offers a counter to the narrative crafted by the New York Times. And I'm not saying the New York Times narrative is wrong. I'm saying that Levitz pointing out that they missed a piece of what matters here, the takeaway, really gets to the future of the Democratic Party. Levitz writes about, well, just one little piece of this. He talks about Governor Ralph Northam's blackface experiment in college that leads to this photo surfacing 35 years later. And he points out that, as the New York Times does, that, you know, if you were to just look at Twitter, you would guess that the general consensus among Democrats is that Northam needed to resign and has not, and that's a problem. If you look at the most dedicated Democratic Party voters in Virginia, they don't agree. They are happy with his apology and don't think he needs to resign. The New York Times putting a spotlight on this, Levitz right, drawing from the survey by the More in Common Project. Again, he describes them, I think, accurately as a militantly moderate organization. It's a credible survey. And what they conclude in the survey is that there is this gap that Democratic voters, as Levitz writes, are less woke, ideologically motivated, and less attentive to the news cycle than you would gather from what appears on social media or is printed in the op-ed pages or is discussed at Democratic Party fundraisers and activist events. Progressives who assume that Joe Biden's history will automatically condemn him to the dustbin of history, Levitz writes, are indulging in the pundit's fallacy. So Levitz is basically agreeing for the most part with the conclusions of the moderate group's intense and vast survey of a large number of voters. What he disagrees with, though, is the conclusion. In the New York Times piece, the conclusion seems to be that Democratic Party activists, the elite class of the Democratic Party, the people who are dealing with or offering up the most money, the people who are organizing events and attending events, the people who are very plugged in to what their congressional representative or what have you is doing, the people who are spending time talking about politics online, that these people are in a class that is just so far away from where the average reliable Democratic voter is. And so the New York Times is, again, taking part in something you won't see them or any large media organization do to Republicans. They're positing subtly in their analysis of the survey that Democrats once again need to moderate. They need to come to the middle. They need to let the centrists guide the party. How many times have we heard this? Honestly. Regardless of how old you are, you have been faced with this. In county party politics, in state party politics, in presidential election years, in midterm years, if you're a progressive, if you talk about politics online, if you are an activist of any sort, if you are a regular donor, if you do anything more than watch the nightly news and read the newspaper when it comes to politics, you fall into this activist class And you, according to the New York Times analysis of this survey, are the fringe of the Democratic Party. And so therefore, again, not stated outright in the New York Times piece, the conclusion subtly alluded to is that Democrats would see their electoral chances skyrocket if they once again track to that mushy middle. Let the centrists guide the narrative and the policy. Let the moderates be the spokespeople of the party and just chug ahead. Business as usual. Corporatism's concerns be damned. No, absolutely not. When it comes to the Democratic Party and this, again, not attacking the conclusion that there is a gap. There is a gap. It's a big gap. But this whole idea of how to respond to that gap misses something that is, again, far more understood when it comes to pundits, the media, political analysis, and even at times political scientists analyzing this gap. Conclusion that they come to, different for both parties. Republicans are never urged to track towards the mushy middle or find their centrist calling. But Democrats are. Democrats are always in specific policy battles expected to moderate, to compromise. Republicans drive the country towards a government shutdown every 3 months over the last several years. And yet that is responded to basically and usually with, how are Democrats going to negotiate with these Republicans? How are they going to find a place to meet? What Levitz writes about at New York Magazine, though, is taking that all into account, taking the survey the New York Times writes about all into account, taking in many of the things he's written about before, from the problem with the tribalism in our politics actually being more closely attached to the donor class and even the conservative movement itself, its successes, ironically, have more to do with polarization than anything else. Taking into account his writing before on identity politics and its inseparability from policy discussions. Taking into account the results of 2018, when Democrats running on policy, health care, immigration policy, and more, still spent the final 2 weeks of the election in 2018 talking about caravans and not really being willing to come right out and say the president's a racist. What's the takeaway from that? It's not that, I mean, obviously Democrats did well in 2018. But the lesson it tells us is that regardless of how much they talk about policy, these firebrand issues are going to be a gimme for Republicans to fall back on. Or to put this another way, demagogues like Donald Trump always have racism to fall back on in a pinch. Their party won't judge them for it. Their party elites nor their voters will hold it against them. And Democrats never seem to be able to respond. If you don't think that this is going to be a large part of 2020, to be blunt, you're an idiot. Speaking to the current Democratic Party elites, state parties, national party, county parties, I don't care. The majority of you in those positions are probably guilty of this. It matters. This isn't just as simple as when I say the Democratic Party needs to embrace identity politics. I don't mean embrace it the way Donald Trump has. I don't mean embrace it the way the entire Republican Party has for 30 years. What I mean is that the Democratic Party's attempt to sever identity politics from the policy debates has left them in a position that is much harder to defend as it plays out in practical real time during an election than is necessary. The solution to all of this is an embrace of identity politics by the Democratic Party and its candidates, and a full-on, both feet in the pool, move towards class warfare. I know, shocking, right? Who would dare suggest such a thing? But that's my point exactly. This is such an extreme proposition for the Democrats. Now, the Republican Party is already there. They're already there. In 2020, just like they have so many times before, they're going to run on racism, xenophobia, calling Democrats baby-killing socialists. These are all identity politics dog whistles, just like welfare queens were, just like the battle against same-sex marriage being framed as a defense of tradition. This is identity politics at play. And to some extent, the GOP has been waging class warfare since Ronald Reagan, successfully for the most part, from framing how even Democrats talk about tax policy to our current debate that we are about to launch into in 2020 over the state of the economy at large. Who's doing really well and who's not? All of this goes back again to the Democratic Party's inability, for plainly corporatist reasons, to actually jump into this pool where the Republican Party has been casually back floating and basking in sun rays for 30 years. Now, again, this isn't saying let's go down the same route in the same way. There are a lot of things that the Republican Party has embraced out of political expediency that are going to kick their ass eventually. This is an argument for speeding that up, and at the same time, increasing Democratic Party odds in the upcoming election and elections beyond that. And I think most importantly, actually crafting what's been missing from the Democratic Party for so long because of the corporatist concerns within the party's elite, which is an actual party identity. So, not following the Republicans down the same route the same way is going to require being willing to be practical when necessary, and that's still something that will, for the time being, be key to Democrats in speaking to their base. Republicans don't have to worry about this as much. But what this doesn't exclude and shouldn't exclude is an embrace of the identity politics that drive Democratic voters, an embrace of class warfare to the extent that they realize, look, let's step back a little bit here. Hillary Clinton lost the election for a lot of reasons. And to be honest with you, if that were to play out again today and they knew that a handful of counties in a smaller number of swing states were going to hand the election to Donald Trump, most likely it would be very easy for her campaign apparatus, the machine, to win that election. On a broad sense, she was hurt by last minute shenanigans by James Comey. She was hurt by overall the poor timing of the New York Times and their poor judgment in headline choice. There's so many factors that can tip the handful of counties that worked for Trump, I think even as a surprise to him. Playing that out again, a smarter machine, the election probably goes a different way. But that doesn't mean that there aren't real takeaways when it comes to her messaging. Why was Hillary Clinton in a position where things were so tight? That's something missing from this discussion within the Democratic Party. We're so busy having the fight over whether or not she should have been the candidate in the first place. We're sort of missing the forest for the trees. Why was it so close? Sure, credible argument that that same election playing out again and one or two minor mechanical changes within her party or campaign apparatus and she wins. Very credible argument. Doesn't matter. Why was it close enough that that could matter? I don't think it speaks as an answer. I don't think it speaks to any practical look forward to just say she was a weak candidate. At the same time, she was, for a lot of reasons. And one of them that isn't getting discussed that gets back to exactly what I'm talking about here today, her damn campaign slogan, Stronger Together. That sounds great. And I even get the calculation that went into this campaign slogan. You're about to run against one of the most divisive, racist, polarizing, unpopular with his own party presidential candidates. Running some sort of unity message probably made a lot of sense. And I'm sure the political consultants were lining up left and right to help craft that unity message. But here's where the political consultants that did so really got it wrong. Like, really. It's an inability to some extent for, let's stick with political consultants as a focal point here to make this argument. It's an inability on the part of political consultants to move away from this weird gun shyness over, for example, actually calling the president a racist. Political consultants left and right are out there still right now telling Democratic candidates in congressional races, and you'll have them telling the presidential candidate the same thing. Don't call the president. Don't say Trump is a racist. Don't say it. Too far. That's just going too far. Just over this last week, we've seen these bad faith attacks against a sitting Democratic congressional representative, Representative Omar, in which party leadership, Nancy Pelosi herself, love her to death, but man, not even willing to come out and directly defend a Democrat in her own caucus who is basically the victim of the president inciting violence against her on Twitter over 9/11. And the best Democratic Party leadership can do is to come out and say the president is bad. They won't even come right out and defend by name the Democrat under attack. This is not accidental. This is coming about because there is this conventional wisdom that won't die. The zombie ideas of how Democrats have to campaign, perpetuated by the media and the party elite with no credible evidence. Great example played out over this weekend. It's just one example. I get it. But political party, well-known Democratic operative, if you will, political consultant, Eric Schmelzer. He runs the Winning Progressive Organization, or helps to. They've been very successful. They're very well respected. And he wrote in response to all of this inciting violence against Muslims and Representative Omar from Minnesota. He writes, Trump's now pinned his tweet inciting violence against Muslims. And tags the representative in it. Why? Schmelzer writes, because he's decided it's better for him if we focus on this over ordering officials to break laws, demanding refugees be dumped in sanctuary cities, and burying the Mueller report. And believe me, I'm glad the presidential candidates condemned it and wish Speaker Pelosi and Chuck Schumer would call out his racism and say Omar's name directly, not saying they shouldn't. But at the same time, he tweets, he'd much rather have a debate about this and his hating Muslims than all the other things. So here you have a political consultant that will be a big part of I don't know how many campaigns in 2020 saying, yeah, this is bad. Yeah, the president is a racist buffoon. And yeah, I wish that Democratic Party leadership and operatives would condemn it more directly and even mention the congresswoman under attack's name. But Schmelzer then qualifies. The president likes it when we do this, so we shouldn't. The president knows that falling back on racist demagoguery is something that helps him with his base. And so the Democrats should, I guess, Schmelzer's idea is ignore it and just talk about other things. Yeah, we've tried that. That's exactly what the Democratic Party is getting wrong. What the political consultant class out there is completely missing is that people like Trump will always, regardless of what you're talking about, and again, we saw this in 2018, regardless of what you're talking about, regardless of how much meaty, intelligent policy discussion you include in your campaign for Congress or president as a Democrat, regardless of that, and it's important that that happen. In fact, it's the one big advantage Republicans or Democrats have right now is that Republicans don't have any substantial policy to fall back on. But the argument that that's all Democrats should be doing because the president enjoys favor with his base when he's a racist, the idea that we should just ignore that and talk about the policy alone as if it's some binary choice, as if the policy and identity politics and class warfare aren't intimately connected in the minds and lives of actual voters out there living it, is idiocy. And this idiocy is what is being piped into the ears of Democratic candidates for a generation now. So backing up again, why is it happening? Money in politics, corporate donors, quiet embrace of corporate elitism within the Democratic Party, something Republicans can get away with because any policy they do happen to stumble upon, the two don't conflict. For Democrats, a bit of a different situation. The ideologies of the party, the most popular beliefs within the party and the electorate at large often do conflict with corporatism. And yet Democrats need money to win elections. How do you thread that needle? Well, the way we've threaded that needle before is exactly what Schmelzer said. Republicans enjoy favor and clapping from their base whenever they're called a racist by a Democrat or whenever they say racist things, whether a Democrat calls them out or not. And so because of that, Schmelzer and the political consulting class concludes, we should just ignore it. Just pretend, you know, yeah, condemn it, put a statement out, but then move on to talking about healthcare as if it's a binary choice, as if healthcare is severable from the identity politics out there driving real life voters that, again, vote who they think they are because of their experience, are not ever excited by a quick statement and moving on. What they're excited by is feeling like someone's got their goddamn back. And a person doesn't have to be Muslim to be excited by a stronger condemnation by Nancy Pelosi over this last weekend of the president's inciting violence against Muslims, and specifically a Muslim congresswoman. That's something that would excite the entire base seeing a strong condemnation of it, coming out and actually saying this is racist demagoguery that could put a congresswoman's life and family at risk. And instead, what we got was, what the president said is bad, but we should all talk very carefully about 9/11 because it's sacrosanct. Weak. True, but weak. Awful, actually. So I know it's impossible for Democrats. I know there are a lot of people out there that, and I get the ideal. There are a lot of people out there that believe that Democrats can shut the door on the corporatism and win elections with grassroots campaigning. And I want to believe that's possible. And maybe it will be one day. The reality is it's not going to be the reality in 2020. In 2020, large donors and the corporatism that has hijacked the party, trapping Democrats into this mushy, jello-like, moderate centrism, basically hostage situation, is going to be a factor. It's going to be at play. If we'd started fighting this years ago, and many tried, we'd be in a much better position. Right now, the corporatism is going to be a driving factor. But that said, Democrats, going back to Eric Levitz in the New York Magazine, can reach out to moderates in 2020, can engage Democratic voters that aren't a part of this elite class the New York Times writes about and the survey reveals, by waging as Levitz writes, a vicious class warfare. Here's what the Democratic Party is missing. Honestly, Levitz writes about Elizabeth Warren as the party's left flank, just as an example, and Joe Biden as its rightward-most flank in this upcoming nomination battle. He writes about diversity being the strength of the Democratic Party, bigotry, the weakness, and progressive pushes over the years to pull the Democratic Party away from this weirdly visionless moderate centrism. And he points out that what you basically see stacking up here, again, using just Warren and Bernie Sanders on one side and Biden and I can't remember who else on the other. He says basically you're seeing this division kind of break out again as it has 1,000 times over for the Democratic Party. What's happened in the past is that moderate centrist corporatist middle has won out time and time again because, well, again, the reality that money and politics are a necessary evil right now. You're fighting against a party that's going to have that money. You're going to need it yourself. That's unfortunate, but a reality. And what Levitz concludes, and I think he's really onto something here, is that if you look at the polling for decades, if you look at the political science that is pretty decided and not at all torn on this, what you'll see is that, overly simplifying it here, but pitting the people against the 1%, as Warren has been very, very consistent in doing as a senator and in her campaign so far, isn't as bad as pitting whites against illegals. It's not the same demagoguery. It's not. And Republicans aren't going to be afraid to pit white people and white voters against, quote, illegals. In fact, they've already signaled they plan to run almost entirely on something like that, but spread it out to a gazillion different targets. That's what Democrats are up against in 2020. That's what Trump did in 2016. The idea that we can just ignore that, not challenge it. The idea that we could adopt, Cory Booker, I think, is coming the closest to following the Hillary Clinton campaign strategy with his talk of unity and coming together and being one nation. I mean, that's it's a great message, and it's something that is key to the Democratic Party's past and future. But imagine the voter out there that feels like the rich, and it's worth noting, this is by far a majority of voters. According to the American National Election Studies survey, you could even argue that it is a majority of voters in every possible political ideology you could research and political party. With that in mind, imagine those people, by far a majority of the American electorate, that feel the rich have too much sway, that they have too much power, that even the tax code works for them best and leaves others behind. Imagine responding to that person's concerns with, we should embrace diversity in our economics. We should embrace diversity in who gets the most from the tax code. No. No, launch an outright class war against the rich. Don't be afraid to do it. Again, I understand that this route leads to the same demagoguery of one against another that has made Donald Trump a success with his party, and that his party has embraced for a generation before him. I get that. One of the reasons I think the Republican Party has gone fully down that road of pitting one against another and having that be the majority of how they campaign every cycle is that they don't have the policy to fall back on. They don't have any actual policy that is popular to tie to that demagoguery. So they're left with just the demagoguery and it runs rampant. Democrats have the policy. Barack Obama, Levitz writes, his decision to appeal to the public's class resentment in 2012, casting Mitt Romney as an out-of-touch plutocrat, Levitz writes, played a significant role in his reelection. Data from the ANES 2013 Recontact survey, Levitz writes, shows that resentment of the rich was strongly correlated with support for Obama. People came out to vote for him because of that resentment. Democrats can't ignore that. We have been, and we've been giving it lip service occasionally. So back to the New York Times article on the militant moderates survey of 8,000 likely 2020 voters. Levitz concludes that, yes, Twitter is not real life. And that, again, is just kind of an example or a convenient way of saying that the electorate is different than the activists or the diehard political junkies with a loud megaphone or even the donor class. And the electorate is different from the political consulting class. And what the New York Times concludes from the survey is that that's the lesson for Democrats. Your voters are far more mushy middle than these loud progressives would have everyone think. So once again, moderate, find a way to negotiate with crazy Republicans and everybody's happy. The New York Times concludes because, you know, they're the liberals in the media. Levitz, I think, has a much smarter takeaway, which is to remember that these elites, whether it be large money donors or progressive organizations currently receiving some favor and spotlight from the media, activists who have been around and know how to fight within the party and without, yes, they are different than the average voter. Yes, progressive activists wanted to see Northam resign. The average Democrat in Virginia didn't want him to resign and thought his apology was good enough. Yes, that's all true. But the takeaway isn't that the Democratic Party needs to rush to that moderate centrist middle and the zombie ideas that it's produced over the last 10, 20, 30 years. Levitz says the takeaway is to remember that the elites, well, the elites, the activists, the most plugged in organizations with a loud megaphone, they can make Twitter real life. Or to put that another way, there is no credible argument that the Democratic Party wouldn't benefit much more from, rather than chasing, once again, the moderate centrist middle, but instead turning to voters and saying, this is a class war, and we're tired of you and your identities, which you understand fully, getting screwed. And we're going to be the party to fight for you. And having that play out on top of all of the credible policy Democrats will have to talk about in 2020, stealing the thunder from the president by simply responding to his racism, by calling it racist. Yeah, it really could be that simple. Pitting the average American against the rich. The Democratic Party embracing that in 2020 isn't going to cause the class war. The class war is already here. The Democratic Party just needs to decide which side, the currently winning side or the currently losing side, they're going to stand up for and hope to receive a favorable nod in the election from. Some great evidence in all of this. Really recommend everyone check out the Eric Levitz piece in New York Magazine. For Democrats, Twitter is not real life, but it could be. I've barely touched on it here. He digs through a lot of the latest political science, years of public polling and research around that. And I think he stumbled upon a real takeaway for the Democratic Party heading into 2020 that, unfortunately, over the weekend, we saw leadership not embrace with their choice to moderate in their response to a racist president. I'm Jason Williams, and I'll see you next week.